It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Wild animals get injured and orphaned, as people do. And if you spent much time outdoors in Alaska, you may have come across animals in trouble. It can be an upsetting situation. But what's the right thing to do? On today's show, we're talking about animal rescue for marine mammals and birds, and when you should intervene and when you shouldn't. I recently visited the Alaska Sea Life Center in Seward and spent some time with an orphaned sea otter that's being raised for an aquarium. And here in Anchorage, I visited Bird TLC, which takes care of injured avians in our region. It's a fascinating subject, as the wild comes into care facilities, raising lots of philosophical questions, along with the simple wonder of being in touch with these animals. Please stay tuned on Outdoor Explorer. So for this part of the show, we're in Seward, visiting the Alaska Sea Life Center, which is a really unique facility. Folks probably know it sort of as an aquarium. They're coming to look at the animals, but actually this is an important research facility. And one of the things that they do is take care of stranded marine mammals, including sea otters and harbor seals, nurse them back to health. Some will go to aquarium. Some will go, in the case of harbor seals, will go back to the wild. And something that I think would be is of great interest to those of us who are out in the on the water this summer, because we see animals and we know that there are animals that are stranded or in trouble. What do you do with them? And then what is the Sea Life Center doing with them? So right now I've got Brett Long, who's a husbandry director here at the Sea Life Center, to talk about their work. And Brett, I mean, taking care of marine mammals is it's not like having a tetra in your fish tank. I mean, this is a really complex thing that takes a lot of staff, a lot of food, a lot of training, and a really unusual facility.
Yeah, you know, we have a dedicated staff of very skilled people that have been trained to take care of these animals. They aren't, as you said, like taking care of your fish in your aquarium at home or maybe your dog and cat. They require a lot more invested time to make sure that the food that we're providing them meets all the nutritional needs that they have, and that the environment that we're keeping them in meets all of the environmental parameters that allow them to live healthy lives. And so it definitely is a more challenging task than what would normally think that just taking care of an animal.
So you were saying that the sea otter that's down in the, I don't know if you call it the lab or the rehab facility now.
ICU.
There's somebody there 24 hours a day taking care of that animal.
Yeah, so sea otter pups in particular are very dependent upon their moms in the wild. And so they eat around the clock, generally every 2 to 3 hours. So if you're a mom sea otter, you would be foraging and then nursing your pup throughout the night. And so when these animals strand and we in essence become their surrogate mom, we have to follow that same type of cycle. And so when a sea otter pup strands, we do what we can to meet its caloric needs and its hydration needs very early on, and then hope to transition it onto a bottle so that we can deliver it a formula that we make here that is to recreate basically mom's milk. And so that animal is on a 3-hour schedule. It's very similar to a preemie human that's in the neonatal unit, and that every 3 hours it needs to be fed, it needs to be groomed, it needs to take a nap, it needs to have help with urination and defecation, then you need to clean it up again, feed it again, nap, and that cycle, generally when they first get here, it's every 2 hours they're getting fed, and then after the first couple weeks that can get stretched to every 3, and that goes on until they're 3.5-4 months old, when they slowly start to wean off of that formula and start eating solid seafoods like clams and shrimp and that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. And you were telling me earlier $20,000 a month to do that, and I can per animal, I could certainly see how that would be the case. So with harbor seals, is it a similar regime, or is it a little not quite as extensive as that?
It's not quite as extensive. And so harbor seals, the natural history is quite a bit different in that the maternal investment with a harbor seal is much less. So a mom harbor seal has a harbor seal pup and tends to stay with that animal for about 3 weeks. And at the end of that 3-week period, then mom goes off in her own way, and then the pup learns how to forage on its own. And so when we bring in harbor seal pups, The first couple weeks, 3 weeks, a little bit more intensive. They don't have to be fed quite as frequently as an otter pup does. Their metabolism rate is much slower, so that it's just a slower process in general. But at about the 3 or 4 week mark with a harbor seal pup, you transition from a formula-based diet or a fish formula-based diet onto small live fish to encourage that foraging behavior that they need to exhibit before they're eligible for release. And then we maintain them for generally about 12 weeks to get them up to a nice weight that would be typical of an animal that was weaned from its mom, and it's already demonstrated that it can eat live fish. And once it meets certain health parameters so that we're confident that it doesn't have any disease processes or any compromised immune systems, then we can work with our federal government and release that animal back to the area in which it was found.
So as I mentioned before, I actually had this experience, which was like an unforgettable experience for my kids, of like the harbor seal pup that was stranded. We called the Sea Life Center. We were told, leave it where it is for 24 hours, but watch it to make sure it's safe. So we camped out and watched that seal, and managed to get it here to the Sea Life Center, and you guys nursed it back to health and released it. And so there's every expectation that seal probably is, you know, just went on about its life as it wouldn't have been able to because it had somehow become stranded.
We have a really good track record with harbor seals. Again, part of it is due to the fact that the maternal investment is much less, meaning much less in time, not necessarily that the mom isn't as invested during that time. And so I love hearing those stories that you just said, because I think that engagement with the community is just so fantastic. And that phone call coming into us and with the, we're going to observe it to make sure that mom's really gone so that we're not prematurely removing an animal from the wild. And then again, over the last 18 years, we have a very good track record with releasing independent, well-adjusted, wild harbor seals back into the wild. So we often put radio tags on the animals so that we have confidence that after they leave our care and are back in the wild, that they, if that tag continues to broadcast for several weeks, we're confident that that animal's at least out foraging. And then we also know its location and that it tends to be in areas where other harbor seals in the wild would be. And so that's a very comfortable way to put them back, because we know that our practices here inspire or give us confidence that success rate remains that high.
Yeah, it's working. So a couple of years later, another harbor seal showed up, actually very close to the same spot. Again, we called the Sea Life Center. Again, they said, watch the animal. We did, and the animal ended up going back to the wild, and presumably that's the best thing that could have happened in that situation, right? I mean, we didn't have to bring this harbor seal to you. You didn't have to spend God knows how much money to take care of it, and it ended up back with its own mother, presumably.
There's a very reasonable chance that it did, mm-hmm. and that absolutely is the best case scenario. And that's why we ask that people observe. And actually, these animals are protected under federal legislation, and so it isn't legal to go and just pick up an animal. And so the best case scenario is that by stepping back and observing, that animal then has an opportunity to reunite with its mother. And so with harbor seals, there are times where the mom might leave for a few hours at a time while it's out foraging. And so seeing a harbor seal on a beach by itself or a harbor seal pup on a beach by itself doesn't necessarily mean that mom isn't around. She's just not there right then. And so standing back and watching for approximately 24 hours or through a couple tide cycles, at least gives that opportunity for that seal to reunite with its mother. You're correct in that we don't know 100% that that's what happened, but the best answer for that population and for marine mammals in general is to let them be reared and raised by their species or their mothers.
So, I mean, if you see one of these animals in the wild and you take it upon yourself to say, well, I'm going to rescue this animal, if it's a harbor seal, especially if it's an otter, you actually could be giving that animal a death sentence.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's not always successful in the rehabilitation process. And more to the point, if it's an otter pup and it's removed from the wild, there's no chance that we can provide the same type of maternal care. And so that animal will not be allowed to be put back in the wild. We can take care of it. We can keep them healthy. We can teach it to eat the food that we feed it. But we do not have the ability to teach it to eat and groom the way in which a wild otter does. And so picking up an otter pup in the wild prior to calling One, it's actually illegal, but more important than the legal status of it is that you have removed that animal from the wild and it can't ever go back.
Mm. Yeah, then that's heavy. The Outdoor Explorer, we're talking about animal stranding in the program here at the Sea Life Center in Seward to take care of these animals and bring them back to health and hopefully that they have a good life. If it's an otter, maybe it ends up in an aquarium because they can't be returned. If it's a sea, if it's a seal, maybe it ends up back in the ocean. And do you guys also rehabilitate birds and other animals, or is it just the otters and seals?
You know, we're a great person to call in that we at least can get in touch with the appropriate either federal agencies or nonprofit groups that might be responding to those particular types of animals or species. And so we do also respond to some marine seabirds. More often than not, we try to target or highlight the species that are in some type of threatened status so that we can direct our efforts and calories towards species that have more challenges in the wild. And so very appropriate to call us if you see any injured marine animal, whether it be a bird or a mammal. But the manner in which that animal is managed is up to the federal agencies that have oversight, and we work with them to try to make the best decisions.
Yeah, and that brings up a really good topic, Brett. I'm talking to Brett Long who, at the Sea Life Center, who's the head of the husbandry department here, is the philosophy of this, right? Because we don't necessarily want to think of animals as just being little people that and that, you know, obviously when human beings are sick, we take them to the hospital, we do everything we can, because that's not their world, right? The world of nature is kind of a brutal one, and it's animals eat other animals, and that's just how it works. And so for you, there must be a little bit of a thing. You're not trying to make these animals into people, right? They're not pets. You're trying to,
absolutely.
And in terms of like saving them, you want to have some, you want to be doing something that has meaning, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the Sea Life Center and most communities, we want healthy, robust populations in the wild. And so we're here to help try to foster that type of attitude. We do want to make sure that any actions we take aren't doing anything negatively to the wild population. Sometimes you can do that at an individual basis, on an individual animal. We try to learn everything we can from individual animals, what the environment they're coming from, any potential diseases or pathogens they're exposed to, again, so that we can apply that information to the larger populations. And then if we can, we appropriately rear and raise these animals in an environment so that we can hopefully release them back. That's the overarching goal. There are times when that's not possible. And that's also not the only way to affect change. I mean, the animals that strand, that we care for, that for some reason are ineligible for release, we have an opportunity then to highlight or showcase that species to millions of people, either the hundreds of thousands that come through the Sea Life Center or the partner aquariums we work with around the world that have millions of attendees that come in and learn more about the Alaska ecosystem, sea otters as a species. And so that is a way to affect change. Again, even though for a wildlife response program, generally you start with the goal is to release healthy wilds to the healthy wild animals back to their natural environment. Sometimes you can't accomplish that goal, so you try to make good decisions. And
there's all these conservation issues that people need to know more about. You know, one of them obviously is being climate change. And, you know, I guess the jury's out as to whether the large number of otters that have been dying in Alaska coast and on MERS and other sea life is because of climate change. Obviously, there was a sea surface temperature anomaly that sort of seems like a likely suspect. And so part of this, I guess, is being able to let people know that that's happening, because we might not know otherwise.
Right. You know, we did see an unusually high number of sea otter strandings, both pups and adults, live and dead, over the course of the last couple years, that did match in time when we saw some larger changes in the environment, both close to them and farther away. So elevated sea temperatures, algae blooms, and those type of things. But these populations, at least this subset in the Kenai Peninsula area and the Homer area, are relatively robust. And they could be just at higher population levels. So therefore, we simply are seeing more animal strand because of that. And so I think it is as you mentioned, that the important part is highlighting these activities and highlighting these changes, and then trying to work with our federal, state biologists and the communities to make long-term assessments of this.
Yeah. So, and I know you take care of a lot of other animals at the Sea Life Center too. You're in charge of husbandry for all of the fascinating marine life here. Tell me about how you learn from that work. I mean, it's really challenging, obviously, to keep these animals healthy and long-term and all kinds of different things. I mean, is research sort of a part of this? And what sort of, you're obviously learning how to keep them healthy, but what else do you learn from having these animals here?
You know, I love working at the Sea Life Center. We are a very unique facility. You mentioned that a lot of people understand that we have an aquarium, and we do. And that aquarium is an opportunity to educate our visitors about, again, marine ecosystems, specific species that are native to Alaska, and to really try to reach that broader audience. But we are equally, if not more so, a research facility. And so more often than not, the species that we're either highlighting or have in our collections are part of a broader research question, or the species is of a higher interest. And so for the last 18 years, we've had some pretty in-depth marine mammal programs that are looking not only at the mammals in our care, but also at mammals out in the wild. And so it's great to work at a facility that has those broad sort of directed questions that are trying to be answered.
Yeah, yeah. So a lot of our listeners are going to be heading out on their kayaks, boats on the beach. And we are going to be interacting with marine mammals and also with birds, but birds seem to be able to take care of themselves a little bit better. And I think it'd be really valuable to let people know what's okay and what's not. I think most of us don't want to interfere with marine mammals and want them to be okay, but by our presence can stress them, right? And we can even, and our pets can even introduce diseases into wild populations. I've noticed, and I've mentioned this before on the show, that when I'm running my boat, if I'm going by the seal haul-out area that's near my cabin, if I keep a steady speed and I don't divert, then they'll stay on the rock.
Right.
If I slow down and look at them, or if I change course, I'll scare them off, and they're obviously wasting energy when that happens. So I've sort of learned that on my own. What are some of the things that we should think about, like with our pets on the beach or when we're kayaking? I mean, you want to get up close, but sometimes you shouldn't, right? So some tips that people might need.
Sure. And so all marine mammals in the United States are protected under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. And there are some guidelines about how close you can get, which in general most people say, hey, try to stay 100 yards away. But the big picture is we're trying to not change the behavior of the animals that we're watching. And so, as you just mentioned, I mean, it might seem minor, but if you're driving by on a boat and you change the behavior of an animal that happens to be hauled out, there's a cost to that. In that case, it's an energy cost. And so our goal should be to observe from whatever distance is necessary that we are not altering the normal behavior of the animal in the wild. And so if you're out in your kayaks or you're out walking the beach and you see a marine mammal or a bird species, I mean, watching from a distance that you can see them, enjoy them, and learn about them is fantastic, but your goal should be to not influence their behavior in any way. And so the general guideline is if you see an animal look at you, then you've just affected its behavior, and so that you should stop there. Hopefully all they did was look at you and that you didn't actually get them to deviate course or go in a different direction.
Mm-hmm. And that goes for your dog as well.
Absolutely. So we say this is a human interaction, but if we have our household pets in our care, then that if they're moving these animals, distracting these animals, or worst case scenario, transmitting some disease from our domestic animals to the wild animals, that is still a human interaction because we're allowing it to happen. And so having your dogs under behavioral control while you're out walking on local beaches so that they don't have the opportunity to get involved. And I mean, as much as I like looking at going, hey, let's make sure we don't do anything that harms the animals out in the wild, the animals in the wild also have things that aren't very good for your pets. Mm-hmm. And so for the safety of your own pet, it's not a good idea to let them interact with and or influence what's going on out there.
Those sea otters look so cute, but when you get close up to them, as I've done on research trips, they're strong, scary animals. They really have sharp teeth, and they're really, really powerful. They could take a dog.
And they have.
Yeah.
and they have. Most of the time, dogs don't win. They are wild animals. They look small, but they can be 60, 70 pounds. And pound for pound, that 70 pounds is much stronger than the 70-pound dog equivalent. Very sharp teeth, a lot of jaw pressure. I mean, they are designed to crush clams and other hard invertebrate items. And it's compared to the bite strength of a black bear. And so even though it's a smaller jaw, it's a lot of damage, let alone the different pathogens and bacteria that they hold in their mouths that cause problems. And so they are not friendly. Yeah. They look cute. I will admit that.
Yeah, they're about the cutest animal in the world, absolutely, especially the babies. So, and I want to learn more, but just for now, just to get that message in one more time, if you see a stranded marine mammal, a seal or an otter would be the most likely. I guess a sea lion is possible, but
very possible.
Okay,
sure.
You call a phone number. You don't touch the animal.
Yeah, you either call any local authority, police, Coast Guard, call the Sea Life Center. You call first, and then we have a 24-hour hotline, or we can be reached on the web at alaskasealifecenter.org. And we will respond and let you know how to handle it appropriately, and then contact the appropriate federal agencies and work under our authorizations with the federal agencies to help respond if necessary.
All right, and we'll make sure those resources are on our website at outdoorexplorer.org. Stay with us as we continue talking about rescuing stranded animals on Outdoor Explorer. So right now we're in the sea otter room where the 2 month old otter is being cared for, and just as cute as he can be, of course. This is a male or a female?
This is a male otter. Again, probably born right around March 1st or so, stranded at about a couple weeks of age in Cordova, Alaska. He weighs about 11 pounds, growing well. They eat about 30% of their body weight a day, so really high metabolic rate. Lots of calories need to go in. And most of that is that they helps them stay warm. And so you have a lot of energy that's devoted to staying warm with sea otter pups. And so they process a lot of food.
And they have that like gorgeous coat, which is so like soft and luxurious. Do you have to actually teach the otter to take care of that coat, or how do you manage that?
We do, and so an otter's coat as an adult is how it stays warm in the water. It actually has the thickest fur of any mammal in the world that can be anywhere from 600,000 to a million hairs per square inch. And to give you some idea that on a normal human, that's probably 600,000 hairs on their whole body. So in one square inch on a sea otter. But the only way that that hair keeps the cold water away from their skin is that it has to be in good condition and groomed, and it forms a barrier between the water and their skin. And so sea otter pups are not born knowing how to groom. Their moms teach them how to groom. Mm-hmm. And so when these animals strand, if it came in at 1 or 2 weeks old, mom had already been grooming it for a little bit. And so it's possible that it started to learn some of the techniques. And then we just have to work with it and try to inspire that type of activity. And you can do that by carefully and safely using a towel on the animal or a small brush. And then anytime you see it starting to move its paws and touch its fur, you try to encourage that behavior. And over time, they can learn that with a little guidance. Mm-hmm. And so right now, this otter actually is a pretty good groomer for his age. There's not a whole lot that at about 10 weeks old that we have to do for him in uh-huh. terms of grooming. If we notice a spot that tends to be a little damp that he's not getting to, we might try to work on that little area or modify where we're keeping him for a bit. But overall, he's doing pretty good.
So now he's having, what is he eating, clams?
And so primarily right now he's on a formula. And so we actually modify a commercially available formula for puppies.
But it looks like he's eating a solid food right now.
He is eating solid food right now. And so about 90% of his diet is a formula, and about 10% is little tiny clam pieces. Because we're trying to slowly transition over time from a milk-based formula to solid foods. And so at this age with his mom, the mom probably would be doing similar things. Primarily, he's drinking mom's milk, but as she's eating, she's probably giving him little pieces and starting that transition. So an otter in the wild,
now he's nursing on the bottle. Oh, it's so, they're so human. I think that's what gets us about them, right?
It definitely makes us get attached very quickly, or at least we can get attached. And so he at the moment is drinking from a bottle, which makes it easier for us to deliver that formula. That transition sometimes can take several days when they come in, and so he is actually very good at it now. He eats about every 2 to 3 hours, 2.5 to 3 hours. And in that time, he gets about 100 cc's of formula and about 10 grams of clam. And that will increase over time as he grows and he can take more. And so that 50 cc's of milk or formula that he just drank, he was able to consume in about a minute. Yeah. Very, very efficient.
Do you name the animals, or do you avoid that, or what do you?
We don't necessarily avoid it. This animal is non-releasable, and so because he was separated from his mother at too young of an age, we won't be able to put him back out in the environment. So at some point, he will be moved to a public aquarium. We generally work with those aquariums to find appropriate names, and by appropriate, we like to find names that might represent where the animal came from. So this is an Alaskan species. We often work with different native groups to come up with names that we can both say to the animal, and that when it moves to its new facility, it takes a little of Alaska with it. Mm-hmm. So he currently does not have a name.
So the folks in Portugal will be working on that.
Correct. Yes.
Funny to think of him being off in Europe, isn't it?
You know, it is. So sea otters, or northern sea otters in general, their home range is basically off the coast of parts of Canada, Alaska, and then around mm-hmm. through Russia. And so this is not a species that you would typically see in other locations, but we are working with partner aquariums in Europe and other locations outside the country right now to find good homes for them that we can introduce people in different areas to this Alaskan species to highlight our ecosystems and some of the challenges we might be seeing in those. And so in the last couple of years, we have moved about 6 sea otters over to a couple locations in Europe, and now over 1 million people a year getting to learn more about sea otters and the Alaskan ecosystem.
And now he's starting to make a sound, which I guess naturally would be a distress sound, but for him it's just a little bit of a complaint.
It can be a distress or a little bit of complaint, or this would be if mom was too far away mm-hmm. and he wanted mom back. And so right now we're mom to him, and so we have to guess what it is that he's trying to tell us. And my guess is he'd like some more formula, but he's growing at a good rate, and he doesn't need any more at the moment.
So. All right. Well, thank you, Brett. This has been fascinating. Yes.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store, or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
We're back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and coming to you from Seward for this part of the show, talking about the program at the Sea Life Center to rescue and rehabilitate animals. One of the purposes of that, of course, is if there's a disaster like an oil spill, to be able to save animals and get them back into the wild after they're oiled. In other words, get them cleaned up and healthy if possible, especially important if it's an endangered species. And right now I'm with Chip Arnold, who runs the program to be prepared for doing that, right? And this is a little bit like being a firefighter. You just hope that you're not needed, I guess.
That's correct, yeah. And what we realized actually in about 2010 is that there was obviously always a potential out there for another oil spill, and we would be the people that would be asked to respond. But we weren't ready. During that period of time, we also were in contact with Alaska Clean Seas, which is an oil spill response organization on the North Slope of Alaska, and it's actually a nonprofit organization that basically their members are oil companies, and so the oil producers have a responsibility to take care of anything that happens during an oil spill, and so part of that is a wildlife component, and they realized they were ill prepared to deal with especially pinnipeds, seals mainly, on the North Slope in case of an oil spill. And so we were contracted with them in 2010 to respond in case there's any kind of an oil spill that involves pinnipeds on the North Slope of Alaska. And at that point, we started looking into it and realized that we weren't prepared to respond. And because of that, we put in place an oiled wildlife response team here at the Alaska Sea Life Center, which has been trained in the things that you need to be trained in to respond to an oil spill. During the Exxon Valdez, it was less organized. Now you can't even show up and participate to help at an oil spill unless you have a basic level of OSHA training called HAZWOPER, which is Hazardous Waste Operations and Emergency Response. And even oiled wildlife responders have to have that training in order to participate. It's like a ticket to the proceedings. And so seven of us went up to Anchorage, spent 3 days becoming HAZWOPER certified, and very quickly as an organization we realized we needed to provide that training in-house, because it was kind of onerous to send people all the way to Anchorage for three full days to get this training. And so I guess I was I volunteered to go up out and become a HAZWOPER instructor. And once we did that, once we started having in-house programs, we were attended in one of those programs by representatives from the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, which is a nationwide accreditation organization, and the Alaska Sea Life Center is an accredited AZA, or Association of Zoos and Aquariums, member. And they liked the program so much that they invited us to come down and start national training, and we've done that. And so now we have 119 wildlife responders across the nation, and one in Mexico. So we're international now. That's our claim to fame. That have been trained in HAZWOPER. So they have that basic training they need in order to respond to an oil spill. And we keep up that certification by having annual refreshers.
And you use your husbandry that you're doing here on a daily basis, which we heard about earlier in the show, when animals are rescued, you're learning how to take care of them so you can deal with that. But if there was an oil spill, you'd have to blow that up into a much larger program very quickly, right? Is that something you've also prepared for?
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons why we've reached out and gone nationwide, because we can go to zoos and aquariums, which have animal care experts in them, as long as they're properly trained. Most of them that we've dealt with have readily agreed that they would love to come to Alaska or have us come down there in case they have a need. But this expands that network of professionals that know how to care for these animals and can be of most use, especially in the initial days of an oil spill, to respond.
And what about the equipment? Is that stockpiled somewhere to sort of to do some kind of quick response?
That's a great question. And part of the grant that we have is to identify resources all over the country and make those available. And also, we at the Sea Life Center, and Brett, who you just talked to, has quite a bit of experience in oil spill response out of California. We have developed, for instance, a portable pool, a 15-foot portable pool that has its own life support system that we can take out and assemble wherever we need to and treat animals where they live, basically, and which is the most successful way to treat them and then return them to the wild in an oil spill disaster.
Hmm. Will there be a role for volunteers? I mean, the last time, and God forbid it ever happens again, in 1989, it was largely a volunteer operation. But it sounds like with the technicality that you're talking about, if a volunteer didn't already have the 3 days of training and quite a bit of other knowledge, they really wouldn't be able to be part of it. So it'll be a professional operation next time, it sounds like.
Mainly that is the case. And one of the reasons the Association of Zoos and Aquariums got involved in oil spill response or is latched onto our program is because about 70 wildlife professionals from across the country responded to the Gulf oil spill and were turned away because they didn't have the prerequisite certifications. Now, that's not to say that volunteers won't be used. It's just they're going to be a little bit delayed to get the proper training so that their human safety is number one, so they're safe in these
situations.
Right,
and that was a big problem in 89, that people did sustain the injuries from the chemicals they were exposed to, yeah. Well, it's great you're doing this work. It's sort of nice to know that there's somebody looking out for the animals if such a thing should happen.
Yeah, I mean, we're doing our best. We've also recently gotten a grant from an anonymous donor that is letting us develop a mobile treatment center, 8 Connex units that we're turning into food prep areas for animals, veterinary hospital, staff support, and utility trailers, so that we can take those anywhere in the state and set them up, and take care of animals in an oil spill.
So that was a private individual that funded that?
It was a foundation. Oh. And again, they're an anonymous. Oh. I can't mention their name, right. It's wonderful. They're focused on wildlife. They're focused on, you know, being prepared. And that's the toughest part of this whole thing is staying prepared because, oil spills don't happen very often, fortunately. Mm-hmm. The fact of the matter is now there's a lot more oil being transported in the lower 48 where they're even less focused on this than we are. Mm-hmm. And, by rail, every year the amount that's mm-hmm. of crude that's transported by rail it grows astronomically, and also all of the pipelines that come down from the Bakken oil fields and that sort of thing. There's a lot of oil potential for oil spills in areas where wildlife may be affected.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Chip Arnold, he's the operations director here at the Sea Life Center and is in charge of this this oil spill response preparation. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me on.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. I'm back in Anchorage now at the Bird Treatment and Learning Center, which is an industrial park in the south side of town. And this is where injured birds come to be rehabilitated in Anchorage, and I guess probably in the whole region. And it's not a fancy place. It's in a industrial center, though I guess there's a new center being built. Guy Runko is the executive director, and just wanted to learn about the center. You guys are volunteer, running a lot of volunteers and a lot of contributions.
That's right.
Just so you can take care of these birds.
Hi, Charles. Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
So my name is Guy Runko. I'm the executive director of the Bird Treatment and Learning Center. And we are a center here in Anchorage, Alaska that provides educational presentations to the public. And we also rehabilitate injured and orphaned wild birds.
Yeah. So, and it got started, I guess, because there were birds that were injured and there were some vets who wanted just to take care of them, right?
That's right. In 1988, Dr. James Scott and some volunteers saw that there was a need for somebody to take care of injured birds here in Alaska. At that time, there was nobody doing this. So he stepped up and talked to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and started rehabilitating injured and orphaned wild birds.
So how does a bird come to you? What's the process for that to take place?
Well, there are a couple different ways that birds come to us. Some birds are just brought in by some people that find them on the street or find them when they're out on the trail and feel like they should provide some help for them. Other people call us sometimes and tell us that they've just seen an injured bird. And then we figure out a way to go out and rescue those birds. And then other birds are sent to us from abroad, from outside of Anchorage, and flown to us. Raven, Alaska is very kind and provides...
Aptly named.
Right, totally. They're very kind, and they fly a lot of birds to us for free. Alaska Airlines does the same to a slightly lesser extent. But we serve most of interior Alaska, northern Alaska, and western Alaska, as well as south central.
So, I mean, when somebody finds an injured bird... they obviously should find out what to do with it before picking it up. But I mean, I think everybody just feels compassionate about animals and wants them to be taken care of. And so I guess, without going too much farther, if I'm out hiking and there's an injured bird there, what do I do? Do I pick it up and bring it back? Do I, call somebody? Do I just let nature take its course? What's the triage when you find an injured animal?
Sure. Well, the first thing you should do is stand back at a distance, kind of take a look at the bird and try to figure out if it really is injured. Oftentimes, birds will land on the ground and won't necessarily be injured, but maybe won't be completely afraid of you and fly away when you walk by. This happens with eagles fairly often. So if you do think that you've come upon an injured bird, the first thing that you should do is give us a call. We're at 907-562-4852, or you can go to our website at www.birdtlc.org.
And we'll have that on outdoorexplorer.org, as we always do, for the links you hear on the show, so that folks can find it that way, too.
Great. So, yeah, you can call us, and we can advise as to how we should proceed. And if the bird is small enough and you feel comfortable capturing that bird and bringing it to us, we do appreciate when people are able to do that. However, do make sure and call us first. Many times we can mean well by trying to capture a bird, but maybe it's not necessary. So it's important to call us first.
So what kind of situation where somebody would call and you would say, don't do anything? I mean, what sort of circumstances would that be?
Sure. Well, this time of year, what we get a lot of are people that are meaning well, and they find a small bird, a young bird, that's just kind of walking around, not quite flying, and they scoop it up and bring it to us, and they feel like they did a really good thing when a lot of the times these birds are just fledging. They've just left the nest, and they don't necessarily need our help. It's very normal this time of year for young birds to be walking around on the ground or kind of hopping from bush to bush, not flighted yet, but out of the nest. And just because you don't see the parents right there doesn't mean that they're abandoned. A lot of the times the parents will be nearby or out gathering food for the young. So observation is really the key here, just kind of standing back and taking some time to observe the whole situation.
Right, because otherwise you could be doing a lot more harm than good. Definitely. Now, you guys don't only take care of, like, endangered species and birds that, I mean, you're kind of, is there any bird that you're not interested in? Like, if I find some kind of injured bird, you say, no, we don't want that one.
No, we rehabilitate almost all injured and wild birds. I say almost because there are a couple species that the state of Alaska has deemed invasive and we're not allowed to rehabilitate, and those would be rock doves or pigeons, starlings, and a couple other species that we rarely see, mostly pigeons and starlings.
Uh-huh. So what's the process when a bird gets here? Because you're kind of a hospital, right? I mean, that's...
Yeah, we really are a birdie ER. When the bird first comes in, we have the rescuer fill out just a little bit of paperwork about where the bird was found, what condition it was in when it was found, if they provided any water or food, and a couple other basic bits of information. And then we take the bird into our triage area and check it in just as you would be checked in at the emergency room if you had broken your arm and show up there. From there, we're able to assess what's wrong with the bird and decide a course of action.
So the birds would have, like, broken bones and that kind of thing, and so you'll actually set the bones and, like, do it like an orthopedist would do for a human being?
Right. We do have five volunteer veterinarians, and we're very thankful for them, and they are all able to do these things, to mend bones and to do minor surgeries. Major surgeries we do from time to time, just not as often. So, yeah, we're able to do pretty much everything that we need to do right here.
Huh. There must be times when the bird is just too far gone and you just have to euthanize it.
Sure. When it comes to birds, if you can catch them, they're in pretty bad shape, right? Birds rely on flying around to get away from their predators and to stay safe. And if they're grounded, then something's gone pretty wrong. So, yeah, a lot of the birds that come to us are injured to the point where there's not much that we can do. The last possible thing that we can do to help a bird, I guess, would be euthanasia, and we do provide euthanasia when necessary. However, that is our last worst case scenario.
Mm-hmm. So after the bird has been through surgery, I guess it needs to be nursed back to health, and I would think that would be tricky, especially with every different kind of bird. I mean, you've got herbivores and predators and everything in between here, right? I mean, you say you must have like a pantry.
Right. Yeah, we do deal with almost all wild birds, as I said. So some birds eat seed and other birds eat salmon. We do have five different huge freezers right here at the clinic that we keep our fish in, and a lot of the fish that's donated from local fishermen. We're very thankful for that. But other birds eat seed. Other birds eat rats. Some birds eat quail, and we have to have all that in stock and ready to go.
So is that a big volunteer job of caring for the birds, feeding them, nursing them back to health?
Most definitely. Here at the Bird Treatment and Learning Center, we have two staff members, myself and avian rehabilitation coordinator Amy Kilshaw. We couldn't do this job, just she and I. So we do rely on our help from our volunteers, of which we have nearly 60 active volunteers that help us get this job done.
Wow. So what about juveniles? I mean, because in a lot of cases, the parent will feed the juvenile regurgitated food, right? And sure. I don't know. Amy doesn't look like she'd be able to do that. She's
no, we'd rather not do that, yeah. Right? No, we do have a recipe that we, a special bird food recipe that we use for baby birds so that we don't have to regurgitate ourselves, Charles.
Okay, good to hear it. Yeah, because then you'd also have to eat bird food and worms,
right,
and stuff, right?
Right? We'd rather not do
that. You don't want to eat any worms, yeah. So, the goal is to release this bird.
Sure.
And how do you get from sort of injured bird through feeding and then back into sort of like a physical therapy or whatever you'd call it.
Right. So when the bird first comes in, like I said, we assess what the problem is and we try to fix that problem. Once the bird is starting to heal, we need to rebuild, regain flight strength, right? The bird hasn't flown for a little while and its muscles are probably pretty out of shape. Mm-hmm. So we have some small mews or aviaries here that birds can regain flight strength in. We also have a flight center on Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in which larger birds can regain their flight strength. These are about 60-foot long mews. There's three of them altogether, so it allows large birds to really regain that flight strength.
So that's a matter of just essentially releasing the bird and birds fly so they'll figure it out, right?
That's right. That's right, yeah. And then after that, once the bird has been flying for a while, we will assess whether it's ready for release or not. And if it is, we'll find the proper location and release the bird there.
Is there any concern about birds will have become too habituated to humans or too habituated to free food and they won't be able to kind of go back to their natural ways, or maybe a juvenile that will sort of have learned how to do those things?
Sure. With adults, it rarely happens, this habituation. They usually know after their first year that humans are bad news and stay away, even if we are the ones delivering food when they need it. We do run into this issue once in a while with juveniles that come in when they're real young and maybe are imprinted because of their time with us. Again, this rarely happens, and what we do in those cases is we do our very best to just either cover our faces or make ourselves, our form a little hidden, you know, maybe under a sheet or behind a door so that the bird doesn't associate humans with free food.
So, as you said, you take in all birds. You're non-prejudiced or non-discriminatory,
right. Right.
Which I guess includes waterfowl that people are hunting and little birds that people don't worry too much about. Obviously, that's not necessarily a conservation thing. You're not taking care of enough birds to sort of help those species. What's the overall reason for doing this? I mean, what's sort of the philosophy behind it?
Right. So helping one bird at a time probably isn't changing the population. This is true. However, what we're able to do is through our rehabilitation and also through our education is we're able to reach an audience and let them know how important the variety of birds that Alaska has is here and how important it is to keep this variety here. So, yeah, some of the birds that we care for are pretty plentiful and some are very rare, but we do treat them equally. They're just as important to us. One thing that we don't do is interfere with natural cycles. If there were a bald eagle that had just swooped down and grabbed a duck, we're not going to run and interfere with that, right? Now, if the duck gets hit by a car, we feel like it's kind of our responsibility to step in at that point. So, yeah, we try to just kind of fix the issues that happen because of human interaction with birds and stay out of the way of natural cycles.
All right, cool. Well, let's have a tour. I'd love to see the facility.
Great. Yeah, let's go.
All right, so now we're in the rehabilitation clinic at Bird TLC with Amy Kilshaw, who's the avian rehabilitation coordinator. And it's basically a garage bay in an industrial building, but you've used every inch, it looks like, for these cages. Yeah. So which bird is this?
Yeah, so in this aviary, we actually call them mews, it's a mew, is a northwestern crow. His name's Cody, short for Kodiak, and he is one of our non-releasable birds, so he's an education bird. We've trained him to be on glove, and he goes out into the public and does educational programs. He lives at the clinic because he likes a lot of interaction. He's a very social crow. He was actually probably taken out of a nest as a young bird and imprinted, and crows, they just imprint on the first thing they see, especially the corvids. They're very intelligent, and so he wants to be around people, so he does better here than actually living with a caretaker. Most of our education birds live with caretakers in aviaries, mews that have been approved by Fish and Wildlife to be at their homes.
Okay, it looks like right now he's just sort of hanging out.
Yeah, I think he's actually hiding. He's a little bit, I don't know why he's hiding right now, but maybe you make him a little bit nervous.
It's much quieter in here than I expected, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Our next patient we have is a northern hawk owl.
Beautiful.
Yeah, they're really, really special birds. You can hear him. That's his little nervous twitter he was doing there. Now, this bird came to us from the valley. It was probably hit No, it wasn't the valley. Sorry, I'm mixing up the birds. This one came from Sitka, the Sitka Raptor Center. They've had him for a while, and he had a coracoid, a structural fracture in kind of his sternum that limits his flight mobility, so he's not releasable. So right now we're assessing his behavior to see if we can make him an education bird, if he'll be a good placement bird.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Moving on. It's actually very, very rare that we have, to say we have two northern hawk owls right now is blowing my mind, but we do have another one who just came in, and this one is the one that came from the valley, probably hit a moving truck or something, and was being attacked by ravens on the ground.
Oh.
His behavior is, he's just exhibiting that he's not seeing very well, so it might have some swelling in his brain. So we're just giving him medication and rest, and trying to hopefully all that swelling will go down and he will, you know, obtain his vision back again.
So he's just been here for a day or two?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he just came in was it yesterday or the day before? I'm losing track of my days now.
That must be really sad when you care for them and then they die, which I imagine happens pretty often.
It does. Yeah, it happens a lot, unfortunately, but half the time it's a good outcome as well. Mm-hmm. And just to be involved with that, it's such a, I don't know, it's rewarding. And, you know, obviously a lot of us do it and we all love it. So, let's move on. We got a Stella's Jay here. So typical backyard bird of Alaska. A lot of them, you know, they do breed up here, and they're very curious, intelligent birds, being in the Corvid family as well. This one came in, someone actually took it from, they found it injured and took it into their house and tried to care for it themselves. And unfortunately it had breaks that couldn't be fixed. And so it's not releasable. And this one hopefully is going to be transferred to another facility.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
So if they'd brought it straight in, you might have been able to deal with those injuries?
Yeah, I mean, if it had come to us right away when it had those injuries, we may have been able to treat those bones and set them in the right positions. Birds have, especially this size of bird, they're very small, and so they actually fix, you can, you know, set them pretty easily, and they can be flighted again, but the fact that it received no treatment and was illegally kept by someone meant that, yeah, unfortunately this bird has a life in captivity now.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Good for people to know that. Yeah, call. don't try to do it yourself.
Yeah. These are actually our two of our education birds. One of them, a subadult bald eagle he just got an injury on his foot, so he's visiting, staying with us right now.
He's so huge.
Yes.
Immature,
yes. Yeah. Well, he's a subadult, but he's full size for, you know, and he's actually a male, so he's actually smaller than, you know, they get. The females are a lot, can be bigger, 30% bigger.
Mind-blowing how big they are, really?
Yeah, I mean, they are, especially in Alaska, they are bigger. You know, we have people visit us from other rehab facilities, and they can't believe the size of the birds here compared to ones found down in Florida or, you know, on the, Midwest and stuff. It's just crazy.
Another eagle? No,
it's a peregrine falcon.
Oh, falcon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is one of, his name's Maverick. He's one of our education birds. Again, non-releasable. And he's getting some just medical treatment right now for some ongoing issues he's had.
Mm.
This is our duckling ICU area. So when we start getting the ducklings in any day now, they'll go in these areas where they have access to water, and we have heat lamps on them. And the wonderful things about the ducklings is that they pretty much take care of themselves. As long as we give them, you know, heat, warmth, water, and food, they just feed themselves. So this is where they start when they get here.
Smart little guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, those are nice, easy ones.
And now we're headed outside.
Yeah, so it's a bit noisy out today. Noisy neighbors in the industrial area. This is our outdoor new yard. So right now we have two subadult eagles. This one actually came from Seward. It was electrocuted. His tail's pretty fried, but
oh my gosh,
he's amazingly, he doesn't seem to be showing any symptoms that he's he obtained any internal injuries. Often if we get electrocutions in, sometimes they will just slowly, you know, go downhill over the first week or so. But he seems really strong, so we're hoping that he's going to be okay. So we're going to transfer him to our flight center soon.
Will the tail grow back?
It will molt out, yeah. So he'll he'll molt in a new tail. And they normally molt in the summertime, so it shouldn't be too long. And they can fly without a tail, especially the eagles. They're not long flyers. You know, they pretty much sit and go just where they need to go, that it wouldn't be too essential for, you know, him to just be released like that.
Okay. This is it's all very basic here. I mean, volunteers have built this, and you haven't wasted a lot of money on, or you haven't had a lot of money to build fancy stuff.
Yeah, we definitely we don't have. Yes, the funds are definitely short, so we you know, we try to do things as best as we can, but as cheaply as we can. Mm-hmm. So this was built by an Eagle Scout. We have a lot of our news, our fence around this whole property was built by an Eagle Scout. It was his project. So we definitely try and utilize the community when we can, and really helps us out, and get people involved.
And what's this eagle's problem?
Yeah, so this is another subadult. Came from, I think this one was from Kodiak. Don't know what it was on the ground. Its left side of its body is missing a lot of its essential primary feathers on the left side, and its tail is mostly broken off on the left side. So if something happened to that side of its, you know, it hit something or something happened, but we don't know what. So again, that one is one that he's got to molt out those feathers, because he doesn't have flight without those primaries on that left side. So he'll go to our flight center soon, as long as we have a mew for him, that he won't have very strong flighted eagles with him. So he can just kind of, have more space out there and slowly, hopefully, molt out those feathers over the summer, and hopefully he can be released.
And are those all your inmates for now?
That's all we have right now.
You've got more room for whoever else gets in trouble.
Yeah, the calm before the storm. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you. Amy Killshaw is the Avian Rehabilitation Coordinator. And thanks for the tour, Amy. I really enjoyed seeing the birds.
You're welcome.
And thanks to Guy Runco, Executive Director of Bird TLC. I really enjoyed the tour.
Thank you, Charles. We appreciate it.
What's the last, and I know that you guys are working on contributions. If folks want to find out about Bird TLC, volunteer or give, you can go to their website, or you can find that also on outdoorexplorer.org. And I guess last question is sort of, what's the takeaway? You know, what would you really want people to know about our role in relating to birds in Anchorage?
Well, I think, we try and help them whenever we can, but sometimes I think people just rush in and try and help these birds that really have adapted to living, you know, right next to us. They nest on buildings, they nest in our, you know, in our houses even. So I think it's just, you know, allowing them to do that and just letting them kind of, letting them live in peace. And if you do suspect there's an injury, give us a call and we can help evaluate the bird and its safety and its situation and see if it does really need care. Because really the best thing is the bird to be, with its others, be with its parents and be taken care by them. And we do get so many birds that are brought into us and just, and they didn't need to be.
All right, good. Well, good advice. And thanks again, you guys. That's it for Outdoor Explorer today. Eric Bork is our producer. Hannah Duro is our assistant producer. My name is Charles Walforth, and I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.